Music from Gail Salmon, quite a songwriter and singer. Come Along, the name of the song. We heard from Buddy Green and Buck White together on There's Power in the Blood, and it's now 10:30 past the hour. Broken Road Radio, that's who we are, and David Allen Putt is here, and I'm Jim Park, and who else? Doug Greenwald with us. George joins us just about every Wednesday morning. Doug, the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. He comes to us from Columbia, Maryland, just outside Washington, D.C., where all the hubbub goes on. And there's kind of a blue cloud over Washington most of the days. Isn't there, Doug? Isn't there kind of I just learned that there's also a place called Foggy Bottom there in the District of Columbia.
I rather think the terminology is better used to say there's a vacuum in Washington, D.C.
Yeah. And nature abhors a vacuum.
Yes, true.
So all sorts of lobbyists rush into it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Except we met a lobbyist last week along with Gisele. You remember Gisele Sorley? You know Gisele.
I do.
And he introduced us to a real Washington lobbyist who works with nonprofits and Christian organizations to solicit money from the government to go through their grant writing and the whole procedure. He performs quite a service. So there are some worthwhile lobbyists out there.
And you know, there are over 25,000 trade associations in Washington, D.C.
Sounds. All with offices
near
the...
All of them will have a staff from 1 to 100 lobbyists.
Oh, okay. I think of all...
You know, influence is the currency of the realm in Washington, D.C., and that's what lobbyists do. They're influence mover arounders, shakers, pushers.
Well, this guy explained to us another function that I hadn't thought of. A lot of lobbyists help legislators write laws because legislators aren't equipped to do that.
Do you think if you're a congressman, you can literally stay on top of 150 bills at any moment in time are moving through various subcommittees that run into hundreds of pages?
Well, at the same time, you're representing perhaps millions of people.
Yeah, I mean, lobbyists do serve a useful purpose, that they summarize the issues in bullet point form for congressmen who are too busy to fathom the issues.
Yeah, there's a good function right there. So my impression of lobbyists is going up. It's not quite at the top yet. Still some reservations, but I learned a lot last week. We're going to learn a lot in mid-June. Doug Greenwald and the Institute of Biblical Context is putting on a conference in Zeeland, Michigan. It's June 12th, 13th, and 14th. We've been talking with Doug about that the last couple of weeks. And you're preparing, you know, last week you were talking about preparing this, I want to call it a book. It's a notebook with all the topics and study guide. It's like a study guide, I suppose. You've got a lot of work to do to prepare for this thing, don't you? What are you doing now?
Well, I'm polishing up that 158-page notebook, which is going to be worth the price of admission all by itself, summarizing 38 different topics that our faculty of five is going to be presenting over 3 days. But about 30 days ago, I was informed of a new resource that actually is going to be introduced at the conference from a friend of mine named Todd Bolin. And for the last 25 years or so, he's been running a ministry called BiblePlaces.com.
I've heard of them. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, a lot of people have. He's been assembling thousands and thousands of appropriate photographs to use to teach the Bible. Mm-hmm. And he has just come out with a new resource called Photo Companion to the Bible, and it's going to be launched at the conference. And when I opened it up and saw what it was, here is the analogy I had in my mind, and actually I've sort of written a version of this for Todd to use as an endorsement. What Gutenberg did for the printed word, Todd Bolin has just done for the visual word of the scriptures. In other words, from his library of 20,000 images, and he's also had access to some fabulous, much earlier libraries, like from the American colony in Jerusalem, where they have photographs that go back to 1850 and 1860, kind of, analogous to Brady in the Civil War.
Catton, yeah.
Sure. So you open this up and you see Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. in the first level of the index. So I clicked on Luke, and then I see Luke 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, et cetera. Okay? Mm-hmm. And then I click, since I'm going to be teaching the parable of the midnight visitor in Luke 11, I opened up Luke 11. And there are probably 100 photographs arranged in order from the first verse in Luke 11 to the last verse in Luke 11 that can be used to help bring that particular verse alive.
Hmm. Wow.
Did you just catch that? So I sat back and I looked at 100 pictures that I could use to teach different parts of Luke 11. And I saw about 6 of them that really would help me in verses 5 through 8. And I've grafted those into my PowerPoint. And I've been doing that for other subjects that I'm going to be teaching. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like a kid in a visual stand candy store.
Bet. I think I crossed paths with them when I was putting together a calendar for our Christian radio station here. And we needed a picture of that. Remember the fishing boat you talked to us about that they'd recovered from Galilee? They have a fantastic picture of that reconstituted boat the on display now in Israel.
Yep, and they do.
That was that. So they're doing great work. Yes.
They are, and I'm delighted that they chose this conference on Jesus in his context to launch this. And I just think this is spectacular. If you love to teach the scriptures and you think that visuals matter, this is the answer to a maiden's prayer.
Mm-hmm. Now, this will be available, but in bookstores or online?
I think he sells it through online through his BiblePlaces.com website.
Okay. So it's a digital publication, correct?
I think it's a huge CD is what
it is. Okay, alrighty. Well, that'd be terrific.
And it's all in PowerPoint format. So you get Luke 1:1. At the top of it, you get the verse, Luke 11:1. Then you get the picture. And then down in the bottom in small print is the source of that picture. You know,
and you can learn about it at BiblePlaces?
BiblePlaces.com.
Okay, every church library ought to get one of those. I can't think of a pastor who wouldn't want that.
Every pastor ought to grab one of those and never let it out of his hands, if you ask me. But, if you think visuals matter and you're a teacher or a preacher or just a serious Bible student who wants to have visual images of the verses that you're studying, this is really a fabulous resource.
Okay, I like
that. So I'm grooving on it, and I'm upgrading all of my what always were visually rich presentations to be even more so. And so that's what's occupying me at the moment.
Did you hear that, David? He said he's grooving on it. Is he a child of the 60s or what?
He's grooving. I'm still waiting for the context goodies. Or is that one of them?
No, grooving, what was that old song from 30-40?
Grooving on a Sunday afternoon. Sunday afternoon. Spanky and our gang, I think.
Spanky and the Rascals.
No, Spanky and our gang. The Rascals were that's the old, that goes back to the 30s, David.
But if a pastor preaches a great sermon with visuals, then his congregation will be grooving on a Sunday afternoon.
I'll bet. Uh-huh. I'll bet. Uh-huh. Good thought there. Yeah,
the Young Rascals. That was it. It's
150.
The Young Rascals.
150. Okay. Well, no, it's our gang. It's Spanky and our gang is the name of the music group. Now, the Little Rascals was the movie kids back in the 30s.
We're talking about the song "Groovin'." It was done by the Young Rascals.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you're the...
Well, you guys can do your homework, but I'm just wondering. Maybe that should be the theme song for this segment on Wednesday morning at 8, you know?
Yeah, could be.
And we're grooving on context.
Mm-hmm.
On a Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, I think you're right, David. I stand, or rather I sit, corrected.
Well, you know, not like it's never happened before.
No.
Well, David, if you're into aha moments...
Aha, uh-huh, yeah. Oh, I am.
You better work your jaw bones and muscles out before you get there. Because your jaw is going to be dropping about every 2 minutes.
Really?
Yeah. What do you get when you get Charlie Horse of the Jaw? Lockjaw?
Yeah, lockjaw, yeah.
That's an occupational hazard in David's business. Radio, it really is.
I've been amazed since I was 2. I wake up in the morning and I'm amazed.
Well, Doug, this is June 12th, 13th, and 14th. You have any room left for more people?
We do. Okay. We can actually even handle walk-ons. Mm-hmm. We're just making arrangements for that yesterday, how we're going to handle walk-ons if they should show up. Mm-hmm. I hope not too many of them show up, because I've had to turn in the food count here yesterday. And I'm going to be making extra notebooks, but not that many. So, yeah, I think we'll be able to handle 20 or 30 walk-ons.
Okay.
But anyway, last week we did an overview of the topics that we're going to cover on the first day. Do you have any memories or reactions to what I overviewed last week?
Well, I think we got through just basically the first day, and it was packed.
Yeah, that's for sure.
I mean, starts at 12:45, goes through the afternoon, and then there's a dinner break, and an evening session as well.
Yeah, that day that starts at 12:45, but day two starts at 9 in the morning and goes till 9 at night.
Mm-hmm.
That's the pack day. And it's going to kick off the very first major presentation on Tuesday morning. It's going to be a mosaic of Near Eastern Village cultural realities. This is something I wanted to do, because in my modest journey through the world of context here, I could never find a resource that tied together all of the major cultural dynamics at work in a village in the Near East in the first century that are always partners in the texts, in the Gospels, and they're so obvious to the readers of the first century that none of the authors even point them out. They don't need to. Everyone would know and understand them. And so I think, because Jesus cites so many of his teachings, his parables, his encounters in villages, what a great resource that would be to understand how a village culturally works. And so we're going to break that up into five sections. For our five faculty members. And I'm going to open it up by setting the stage for a village and talk about some of the minor issues that are at work, how housing works and how bread is baked and that kind of thing. And then Dr. Cindy Parker is going to do a module on social reciprocity, which is at work all the time between the lines of the verses in the Gospels. In fact, this morning, after I leave you all, I'm going to be releasing another one of our contextual reflections. And this one is going to contextually dig into that puzzling parable of Jesus about the shrewd steward.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. You know, like, what is Jesus teaching here is sort of a common reaction from a lot of people.
I've heard so many different versions of that from different pastors that it's like nobody really knows.
Yeah, I think you're right. Mm-hmm. But social reciprocity is embedded in the core of understanding the cultural dynamics of that parable.
You know, we should make mention here, and I don't know how quickly you get the information off the website when somebody signs up for your reflection. Doug's reflection is a monthly newsletter that actually now comes out a couple times a month, sometimes three times a month. It's delivered to you in your email. There's no cost to it, but it will light up your day. And you look forward to these things, and it's a color presentation with some photos typically, and with some copy on a contextual point that will, like I say, it'll make your day. So if you go to preservingbibletimes.org, and if you'd like to, you can link to it from Broken Road Radio right there on our website. Over on the right-hand side of the page is a Preserving Bible Times kind of an icon or graphic. Click on that. It'll take you to Doug's website, and you can sign up for that reflection. How long does it take to start coming? How fast do you get that word, do you know?
On average, 30 minutes.
So people could sign up now and still get today's reflection, conceivably.
Yes, they could.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So social reciprocity is one of the four major dynamics at work in any village situation. The second one is mandatory hospitality. And that factors into the birth narratives, understanding how mandatory hospitality is supposed to work, because the obvious question is, with that in view, why in the world are Mary and Joseph, who are members of the clan of David, who are entitled to mandatory hospitality, why are all of the 300 guest rooms in Bethlehem that night off limits to them? Okay, That's the huge question that gets raised, understanding the mandatory nature of hospitality to not only members of your clan, but the visitors to your village. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, a whole thread that runs through that Luke 11 parable on the midnight visitor. Even though he shows up at midnight, he is mandated to have hospitality.
You know, I think of linguistic issues, and I'm going to ask you a question in a second here, but that's a good example of it, where we read in our Bibles there was no room in the inn. But we know from you that the word was not inn. It's not like there's a Motel 6 there. It's not like there's a Radisson or a Hyatt. It's the word was kataluma, which means guest room, which refers to a very specific kind of quarters inside the local homes, not a commercial rest stop for people traveling. In the conference, did you touch on linguistics at all?
We are. In fact, we're going to do another one of these faculty pool all their insights around the birth narratives mm-hmm. the next day. And Kataluma is one of the subjects that's going to be developed when we put Christmas back into its original context. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah, it's going to be an exciting time.
You asked about reflections in responses to what you talked about last week, and I'm looking at the first session, and you know the first subject of the first day, the history of context, the history of biblical context, and I get the sense that it was, you know, just a kind of a fledgling study of a handful of people in a narrow corner somewhere, and then over a very short time, mostly since, we seem to be in the middle of it, and there's stuff around this movement growing up around us. There's no way to keep up with it, because all of a sudden it's becoming viral. That's going to be interesting.
I think the 2,000-year sweep of history, which I'll be dealing with, the history of biblical context, it was tremendously robust in the first 20 years after Pentecost. Mm-hmm. And then there was an eclipse. There was a cleavage. There was a profound separation between Gentile Christianity and Jewish Christianity, and there are reasons for that, which I will develop. And that separation continued for another 1,950 years.
Wow.
The Reformation didn't touch it. The advent of the historic Roman Church didn't do anything to advance it. It sort of reared its head in 1890 when Edersheim started to do work in this area. He was sort of an early Ken Bailey. But then existentialism came along and created another eclipse of why context mattered. And this is the image, one of the images in my plenary presentation, by the way. I'm using the notion of eclipse. Mm-hmm. Because even though you can't see the sun with an eclipse, doesn't mean the sun isn't there. It's still shining. You just can't see it. So I'm using this notion of the eclipse. There have been various eclipses over 2,000 years that have suppressed context. Mm-hmm. But anyway, to really compress a long story short, only in the last 30 years, because of laptop technology, has context started to come bubbling to the surface. Because now at your fingertips, you can access information that you never could before, unless you were going to take 10 years out of your life and travel around the world to try to assemble these contextual threads that would allow you to then weave the story back together. Mm-hmm. So in part, you're right. It's only been an X functionally since the last 20 years because of the work of like Logo software and people like that, that electronically now all of these contextual resources are available to us at the touch of a finger, and we can quickly get our hands on all the threads that are contextual in a passage, and it makes it so much easier to weave it back together. And that's in part why so many pastors and so many seminaries are not up to speed on this. You know, for the last 150 years, they were oblivious to it. And now we've had this explosion of digital resources, and I think they're one of the last bastions to even catch up to the fact that a whole new paradigm exists out of there called integrated contextual exegesis, which can be powerful in terms of developing a passage when for 200 to 300 years they've been trained to always engage the scriptures through the lens of systematic theology and biblical theology. And so that's two of the three lenses that are helpful, but only in the last 30 years has this third lens of integrated contextual exegesis, contextual restoration, sort of come to the surface. And that's why this conference is so exciting. This is cutting edge. This is stuff that's never been done before.
Do you know if seminaries are getting up to speed on this too?
Not to my knowledge. I'm aware of only one seminary in the United States that even teaches a course on biblical geography. You got to sort of start there, you know. Where are we? We're in the land. How does the land speak? Have you ever thought about how doctors are trained?
Well, yes.
They go into internships and residencies and are taught by older doctors, right?
Well, yes. Mm-hmm. It's in a sense, it's do and teach. You do it, and then you learn the details.
Yeah, but you do it in the way you were taught. Mm-hmm. And so the doctors doing the teaching of today's residents were intern residents 25 years ago, and they were intern taught by doctors who'd been taught a certain way, and that certain way has been passed down. It's a paradigm. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, how do you alter paradigms? How do you give people a new pair of glasses with which to now teach doctors or pastors in a different way? That's the challenge, to break through that paradigmal shift. And do and teach is what Jesus' strategy was, to change the entrenched paradigms of his observant Jewish disciples. And there's a lot that we've got to learn from that. But we're wandering slightly astray here, because getting back to our village, the third major dynamic that's always at work, although it's never called out in these passages in the Gospels, is ritual purity. This culture has a passion for purity, that their behavior always honors God. And that passion and all the stuff that the rabbis have created about how you do this is an implicit part of many a story, many a passage, and many a counter. And it really behooves us to understand this whole ritual purity dynamic that's at work in a village culture.
Let me ask you the question. Was it really a matter of a passion for purity or a passion for ritual?
Actually, it started with a passion for purity, and it evolved into a ritual, which is often how things work, right? Mm-hmm. You lose sight of the original passage, and now something becomes mechanical. A lot of us go through worships on Sunday morning in a very mechanical way. Agree or disagree?
Agree. Agree. Picture the Eucharist and the way that's done. and now you go to a church who does it in a different way, and some people would walk out.
You know, one of the most wonderful church experiences that Nancy and I had was back in the 70s in a Midwestern university town. And there, Pastor Tom had 40 different denominations in his congregation because it was a campus church. And so he decided that there was no way he could have one set worship format. So he developed six. And every week for 6 weeks, you rotated. So worship was never the same next Sunday as it was this Sunday. And he had his progression all the way from, I'll call it high liturgical, which is what the Anglicans and the Episcopals would be used to, mm-hmm. all the way down to what he called an unstructured service, which is what the Quakers and the Brethren would be used to. So every Sunday you came to church was a different worship format. And you know what? That was sort of uncomfortable for a while. But then I began to realize the beauty of that. You never got set in a groove. Mm-hmm. You never got mechanical. Every Sunday was a fresh worship experience.
And you dare not doze off.
That was genius by Pastor Tom.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very creative. Yeah, very
interesting.
Creative.
Yeah.
Well, back to the village. We're not making very much speed here this morning, which we never do anyway.
Yeah, it's okay. It's okay.
The fourth major dynamic we're going to develop on Tuesday morning is the issue of honor and shame. which is deeply embedded into the life of every person in that community that forms that town. Issues of honor and shame permeate the text, although they're never called out. They're always between the lines. They're always operative. They're so common. They're so prevalent. The gospel writers had no need to even mention them. Okay, and that's going to be developed by Reverend Brad Gray, one of the best young contextualists in the world right now. I say young means under 40. And he is a phenomenal teacher. And I'm really looking forward to, because I've seen what he's going to be doing, I'm really looking forward to see it developed in person. Mm-hmm. So those dynamics, and we're going to create the mosaic, we're going to paint by number of what's going on in a village, which I think will be really helpful, because anytime you encounter a village passage, a village parable, a village encounter in the future, you can now draw upon this implicit contextual backdrop to what's always going on in a village and really enrich your Bible study.
Very nice. And again, that's June 12th, 13th, and 14th. It's in Zeeland, Michigan, which is not far from Grand Rapids, correct?
It's about 20 miles south of Grand Rapids.
Okay. And if you're interested in attending, you can still register to attend by going to preservingbibletimes.org, and they'll lay out the details for you there and can make the transaction right on their website, preservingbibletimes.org, if you will. And again, you can link to it from brokenroadradio.com. Doug, what else do we have to know before we adjourn today?
Well, you know, that setting the mosaic of the cultural dynamics of a Near Eastern village, that's going to take us halfway through the morning. And then in mid-morning, we start a new series, because I've allowed each of the faculty members to take 40 minutes and develop their favorite contextual passage. Mm-hmm. Rather than assign a lot of passages, I wanted the faculty to be able to share the ones that really light their own fires. And so I'm really looking forward to this. And so Dr. Cindy Parker is going to open up the second half of Tuesday morning by contextually putting back into place Jesus's encounter with Zacchaeus.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
His name, Zacchaeus, means the righteous one.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that ironic for a tax collector?
It is.
Was given a name not to indicate how he was going to start in life, but how he was going to end. And he's a tax collector, and of course it raises the whole issue, why does he even want to see Jesus? Because of what the rabbis have said about tax collectors, it's like oil and water between rabbis and tax collectors. And so, you know, you got to be struck by, why does he even want to see Jesus? And then you remember what's happened before. Jesus commences his ministry in Luke with calling a tax collector, Levi. Mm-hmm. And that would have spread throughout the tax world like wildfire. One of our own was called by this new itinerant rabbi who speaks with an authority like no other, who is healing people. He walked away from this lucrative tax business. What is going on? Mm-hmm. Who is this Yeshua? I've got to be able to see him. He must be a fascinating person. And then we got all the stuff about the sycamore tree. You know, one of the things we know about Zacchaeus is he's a wee little man, right?
Mm-hmm.
That song from Sunday school days. Well, if I showed you a picture of a sycamore tree, it's a big, thick branch tree, but it starts branching 3 foot off the ground. And you begin to see how a little small person could actually climb up into a big tree.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, there's lots
more
to be
said.
Well,
these people that are teaching, your faculty members, have extensive experience in the Holy Land, don't they?
Cindy Parker, who's teaching this one, lived in Israel for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And goes back every summer to teach 3-week-long intensives, walking the land, for Christian college students. So I can't think of anyone better to really open this up. And she has her PhD in biblical geography. Her thesis was written on the importance of place in the book of Deuteronomy. And she has given me the phrase, the importance of place, quote unquote, that I'm going to be using in the rest of my teaching days, because to the Jewish worldview, place matters. And when she does her opening day session on gospel geography, she's going to develop this thesis on the importance of place. So she's really good for that. And then when she's done, Brad Gray is going to do a 40-minute presentation on John 7, 53. He's going to call this one Written in the Dust. And that's when the Pharisees bring the adulterous woman to Jesus. And Jesus starts writing in the dust. He's going to open up the contextual implications of that particular passage, because it's one of his favorites.
That's one of the passages that expands the most when you learn the context, when you unpack everything that's there. We read across it so quickly and just take it for the matter-of-fact way that it's presented. And there's so many things, as you say, between the lines that we're not aware of in this culture that tell a whole different story.
Yeah, this is where Remez is going to enter the scene and be developed and explained, because Jesus is in the midst of doing an action Remez here by writing in the dust of the earth, which had a very significant understanding, actually a profound understanding to the Hebrew worldview of the first century, because it harkens back to Jeremiah 17:13, and that and so much more is going to be developed there. And then we'll have a slight break for lunch. And then in the afternoon, Reverend Chad Pierce, another one of the younger contextualists, is going to develop the Good Samaritan, the unlikely neighbor, as one of his favorites from Luke 10. And then he will be immediately followed by Dr. Gary Berg from Wheaton, whose favorite passage is the healing of the hemorrhaging woman in Luke 8:40. That's one of his favorites, and he is a world's expert in gospel context, probably the world's expert in the Gospel of John. That's why he's opening up with an overview of John on day one. And then the end of this favorites sequence here, which will take us to mid-afternoon on Tuesday, yours truly is going to contextually restore Luke 11, the parable of the midnight visitor, one of my favorites.
It's another meaningful, another deep one. There's not only bread there, there's meat, if you get my drift.
It's a buffet, a contextual buffet. And that's why I say there's been nothing like this. When you get five people together, all sharing their favorites stuff, both major as well as minor. We call the minor ones contextual vignettes. That's the kind of jaw-dropping stuff that David can't wait to hear. We've got that packed into this curriculum here, too. But anyway, I'm almost to the end of the afternoon on the second day. Haven't even touched the evening yet. And you're just going to have to take my word for it. Boy, is it good stuff.
Well, we will look forward to that. Dad, David and I will be there. And hopefully some of you folks listening this morning, too, will at least check out the presentation of the conference over at preservingbibletimes.org. It's going to be quite a time. We're greatly looking forward to it and the trip to Michigan. Doug, and we're looking forward to you next week. You available next week, or you getting close? You may be.
No, actually, I'm in the car driving to the conference.
I thought that might be the case.
Work to do.
Okay, well, that's coming up, June 12th.
But that'll give you time to find grooving on a Sunday afternoon.
by the Rascals, yeah. Okay, Doug, take care. We'll see you in Zealand.
Thanks, guys. Bye-bye. Looking forward to it.
See you, Doug.